This meeting is now being recorded.
I'm going to go ahead and start the recording and get us kicked off. And I'd like to start out by just going over some of the logistics for our call before I give you an overview of what we'll be covering over the next hour and a half. First, as you've all already discovered, are a large number of participants. We've gone ahead and muted everyone's lines. However, that does not mean that we don't want to encourage a dialogue during the presentation today. As questions emerge, please simply click on the Q&A button kind of in the top middle of your screen, and I will be compiling those questions and presenting them to the panelists at the conclusion of today's webinar. If we have left plenty of time for questions and answers, but if for some reason we're not able to cover all of the questions that come up, as you log in and provide your email information, we should be able to track the questions back to you, and we'll make sure we address them offline after today's call. Also, as I mentioned, I am recording the call, and I will send out a copy of that recording to all of the participants. If you need to communicate with us about something that's kind of more logistical, you can go ahead and use the chat feature on the bottom left, and there's a drop-down menu there. If you want to just direct that to me, just click on my name, Jennifer Kiefer. And then finally, if you have kind of a technical question, on the top right, you'll see a question mark for questions relating to the website. And if you have any audio problems, just click on *0 on your phone. And in either case, someone from the conference line will jump on the line or on your screen and help you sort things out. But it seems like plenty of people are able to figure out the logistics, and so it sounds like we should be able to get started. We do have a really diverse group of folks participating in today's webinar. And so I want to make sure we kind of start out with a level playing field. And so I'm going to kick things off here by providing just a little bit of background, both about Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, and also about combined heat and power and waste heat to power. I know that some of the folks on the line have a lot of expertise in kind of one of these areas or the other, and I just want to make sure that we're starting out with a common language. After I provide those introductory remarks, we'll be turning to Melissa Malarkey, who's with Recycled Energy Development, a combined heat and power waste heat to power developer. And she'll be talking about the business case for including these technologies in 111D, how it might benefit industry. We'll then be addressing a number of issues that are kind of specific to CHP that might come up when both EPA and the states are trying to figure out how to advance combined heat and power and waste heat to power in the greenhouse gas rules. First, Bruce Hedman with the Institute for Industrial Productivity will be addressing how you account for the thermal output from CHP. As many of the folks on the line probably know, one of the key benefits of CHP is that it's providing both electricity and thermal energy. And Bruce will be talking about how you measure that thermal output and also how you convert the energy savings to emissions benefits, because that, of course, is what would be is being regulated in the greenhouse gas rule. We're next going to turn to Vignesh Gaurashankar from Natural Resources Defense Council and Stacey Davis with the Center for Clean Air Policy. And they'll both be talking about what you do about the modest increase in on-site emissions that might be associated with a CHP project. You know, the way CHP works is that you're going to be displacing dirty or central power generation by installing the system and producing electricity and thermal energy on-site. As a consequence, there will be a modest increase in on-site emissions. Vignesh will first be addressing how you deal with that using a rate-based approach, and Stacey will be talking about how you deal with that modest increase using a mass-based approach. And then finally, Rodney Sobin with the Alliance to Save Energy will wrap things up for us. And as I'll describe in just a moment, the way Section 111 of the Clean Air Act works is kind of a collaboration between the federal government and the states. And so a lot of the implementation is really going to fall to the states. Rodney will be providing some discussion about the types of policies that states might consider including in their implementation plans to help advance CHP and waste heat to power. So that's the overview of what we plan to cover during the next hour and a half. Before I jump in, I know a few more people have been dialing. So just very quickly on the logistics, all of your lines are muted. This call is being recorded. As you have questions throughout the presentation, please click on the Q&A at the top, and then I will be presenting those questions to our panelists at the close of the prepared presentation. We should have plenty of time to address them on today's call. But in the event that there are more questions than we have time for, we'll also respond to any additional questions by email. And I will also send out by email a copy of a recording of today's webinar. So with that, let me go ahead and kick things off. And as I said, my goal is to kind of create a level playing field, because I know people are coming at today's presentation from different places. So I want to provide just a very quick overview of where the greenhouse gas rules fit in the Clean Air Act. So this slide here addresses the anatomy of the Clean Air Act, and many of us are familiar with Section 110 of the Clean Air Act. This is what regulates six common air pollutants, or often known as the criteria pollutants. That's ozone, particulate matter, carbon monoxide, NOx, SOx, and lead. And those are regulated through federal NAAQS, National Ambient Air Quality Standards, and then states find ways to meet those air quality standards through their own state implementation plans. So there's a lot of flexibility in those state implementation plans, or SIPs. States are allowed to trade across boundaries and really choose from a whole array of different policies to meet the emissions limit. Much less flexible is Section 112 of the Clean Air Act, and this is what regulates hazardous air pollutants, or HAPs, things like mercury and dioxins. And HAPs have gotten a lot of, I guess I should say, airtime, pun intended, over the course of the last year with the release of both the utility mats and the industrial boiler MACT. Both of these rules are regulating hazardous air pollutant emissions from utility plants, and then also from industrial sources. And 112 is much more rigid than Section 110. So while in Section 110 there's a lot of flexibility for states as they develop their state implementation plans, under Section 112, all the regulated sources have to meet the emissions level of the top 12% of performing sources. And then comes Section 111, and that's where the greenhouse gas rules fall. And we don't hear a lot about it. I have some colleagues at the Natural Resources Defense Council that I've heard dub Section 111 the 40-year virgin. It's been a part of the Clean Air Act since the inception, but it's very seldom been used. And that's because it covers gap pollutants, things that are not covered under Section 110 or 112. So in this case, we're looking at carbon dioxide. And it would set limits for a number of different sectors. The rules that we're looking at right now are the rules for the power plants. And Section 111 is kind of broken down into two different subsections. The first is 111B, as in boy, and that's what covers new, modified, and reconstructed sources. That rule was promulgated by EPA in September, and that rule is out for comment right now. I encourage folks to weigh in. There's actually a number of provisions there that do relate to combined heat and power, and the comment deadline's in about a month. I believe it's May 9th, perhaps 11th. There's also Section 111D, which is what we'll be discussing for the bulk of today's webinar, and that is what covers existing power plants. And the 111D rule is akin to Section 110, where you have kind of that federal-state collaboration and also a lot of opportunity for flexibility. So first, EPA is going to be establishing emissions guidelines. And that's on track to be released this June, so just a few months from now, and right after the comment deadline on 111B. And those emissions guidelines will be released as a proposed rule with about a year, and about a year later will be finalized in June of 2015. And as I said, it was that proposed rule was sent over to the Office of Management and Budget for review last week, so it is on track to be coming out shortly. And then there's this kind of collaborative process. So you have the federal government setting the emissions limit, but then the states have to figure out how they're going to get there using a SIP-like process. And so they're going to be designing programs that meet those guidelines, with those programs likely due in about 2 years, in June of 2016. Now, that's not a lot of time, as I'm sure many of the people on this line already know. As we'll hear from Rodney in just a little while, those state implementation plans might include new legislation. And 2 years isn't a lot of time, to go from kind of conception to implementation of new legislative policy. And so for that reason, states are already starting to think about what they'll be doing to implement the emissions guidelines. Now, what EPA sets is a standard of performance. And that standard of performance will reflect the degree of limitation achievable through the best System of Emissions Reduction, or BSER, it's often called, taking into account the cost and any non-air quality health and environmental impacts that the administrator determines have been adequately demonstrated. And over the course of the next few minutes, I want to unpack some of those words in red on this slide and discuss why CHP is such a good fit. So, again, we're looking at something that reduces greenhouse gas emissions, and we're going to take into account, we're going to consider costs, variety of other benefits, and then finally, things that have been adequately demonstrated. You know, we're looking for proven technologies. And as I'll show in just a moment, CHP kind of fits the bill for each of those criteria. So first, CHP reduces emissions. And what you'll see depicted on this slide is conventional power generation. So at the left there, you've got a box that says 100% fuel. And it doesn't matter what kind of fuel you're talking about, whether it's natural gas or coal, whether it's hydro, whatever your fuel input is, when you've got a central power plant, you're going to be losing about two-thirds of that fuel input as wasted heat just coming out of the smokestacks. And then the waste doesn't end there, because if you have a central power plant, you still need to get the electricity over to the end user. So there are additional line losses through the transmission and distribution of that electricity as you take it from the central power plant over to your end user. In this graphic, it says 3% line losses. It's actually very optimistic. Nationally, the average is about 6 or 7% losses in the transmission and distribution of electricity. Now, CHP turns that inefficiency on its head so that instead of losing about two-thirds of your fuel inputs, you're actually generating useful energy from about two-thirds of the fuel that goes into your process. In the case of CHP, you've got a single fuel that's being used to generate both heat and both heat, thermal energy, and electricity. And then in the case of waste heat to power, you've got an existing industrial process that's emitting heat. You capture that heat, use it to generate additional electricity on site. Now, in both of those cases, you're generating your heat and your power right at the site that it's being used. So you've eliminated the transmission and distribution losses altogether. So at the end of the day now, instead of having efficiency levels at about 32, 33%, you've got efficiency levels to 80% for combined heat and power and waste heat to power projects. Now, that obviously has some substantial environmental benefits. After all, the more efficient you are, the less fuel that goes into the process, and that means the less emissions that are coming out of it. Now, this next slide is going to depict some of those environmental benefits of CHP. And I'm going to be glossing over this pretty quickly. Bruce Hedman will be revisiting this slide, and so you'll have a chance to take a deeper dive in just a few minutes. But let me walk you through what I want you to take away from this graphic. On the left side here, you see conventional power generation. And on the top left, you've got your power plants, and it says your efficiency levels that are about 33%, as I described before. Now, the end user also needs to have some thermal energy for steam, for heating, for air conditioning, and so they're going to have a separate boiler on site. That's much more efficient, but it still does have some emissions associated with it. So when you combine that electricity and that thermal energy, you end up with about 45,000 tons of emissions from 5 megawatts of inputs. On the right-hand side of the same graphic, you see a combined heat and power system. You got 5 megawatt natural gas combined turbine with a heat recovery boiler. And because you're generating both heat and electricity from a single fuel source on site, you're, of course, as we said, much more efficient and therefore have about half the emissions, only 23,000 tons for that 5 megawatt gas turbine. So you can have as little as one half the emissions from your CHP system than what you would have from the separate generation of heat and electricity. And it's for that reason that combined heat and power and waste heat to power would be among the menu of options that states are thinking about and that EPA is signaling to states that they should think about when they're trying to figure out ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. Now, remember, these environmental benefits are not the only consideration that folks are supposed to be keeping in mind. We're also supposed to be thinking about costs and the non-air quality benefits and technologies that have been adequately demonstrated. So let me take just a moment to consider those things. And what this graphic shows is that CHP is also cost-effective. This is a slide from the Business Council for Sustainable Energy's fact book, which was released this winter. And along the column at the left there, you see a whole bunch of different sources of energy. And right near the bottom, you see natural gas combined cycle gas turbines with CHP. And you'll see that CHP has one of the lowest levelized costs of energy across all of the power generation technologies that are being considered. Now, not only is there a low levelized cost of power, but it's also a low source of low cost source of emissions reductions. DOE and EPA released a report about a year ago alongside the executive order, which illustrated that carbon emissions from CHP can come at about 15% the cost of reducing carbon by using distributed solar, and about half the cost of reducing greenhouse gases from wind power. So again, it's very cost effective to use CHP, and it certainly reduces emissions. Now, there also are non-air quality benefits of combined heat and power and waste heat power. I keep talking about how CHP is being produced at the site where the end user is located, and so you eliminate the transmission and distribution losses. There's another benefit that comes with that. Because you're producing electricity on site, that means that these systems can operate independent of the grid. So if the grid goes down because of an extreme weather event, and let's say Hurricane Katrina or Superstorm Sandy, these systems are still able to remain up and running. And so you have tremendous reliability or resiliency benefits that come with CHP, which is another reason why these technologies are really being considered right now in light of trying to figure out how we can adapt to climate change. And finally, CHP and waste heat to power are adequately demonstrated. And you see that depicted on my last slide here. Now, across the horizontal axis, you see a number of different sectors where CHP and waste heat to power installations are already in place. If you were to add up all of those blue bars, those are existing CHP projects, you would get about 85 gigawatts of existing projects. That represents 8% of U.S. electric capacity, about 12% of our electricity, and these projects exist at 4,300 locations in literally every single state in the United States. So this is clearly a demonstrated technology. In fact, it's been around since the time of Thomas Edison. At the same time, there's a lot of remaining potential, and that's what's depicted in these green bars here on the screen. If we were to add up all of those green bars, which are potential CHP projects that have not yet been built, you could see that they run the gamut. They spread across a number of different sectors. And if you were to add up all of those bars, you would get 130 gigawatts of technical potential. And that's just assuming that you're sizing the system for on-site use. In other words, you're not producing excess electricity to sell back to the grid. Now, again, that is technical potential. It's not taking into account whether there's a natural gas line available for the system to use. It's not considering the cost or the payback period. But nonetheless, it does show that there's a tremendous opportunity here. And it's an opportunity that the greenhouse gas rules can help invigorate or can help tap into. So just kind of a quick recap and a foreshadowing of what's to come. I'll be turning in just a moment to Melissa Malarkey with Recycled Energy Development, who will talk about how recognizing the various benefits we just talked about, and including CHP in the greenhouse gas rule, will create benefits for developers and manufacturers. To do that, though, you're going to need to treat combined heat and power in the same manner as other clean energy sources. In other words, CHP is going to need to be treated in the same way as energy efficiency, in the same way as solar and wind, if we want to encourage its use by the states. Also, I think the most important message from today's presentation, and this will be a theme that each of us will revisit a bit, is that in order to allow for CHP, we need to embrace a system-wide approach to emissions reductions. In other words, if we were just to be looking at what power plants can do within the four walls of the facility, well, we would never have an opportunity to look at all of the emissions reductions you can get from hospitals and factories and universities around the United States. So this system-wide approach is key. Next, as I mentioned, CHP produces both thermal energy and electricity. And Bruce Hedman will be talking about the importance of measuring both of those outputs and providing some tools for how you can measure thermal output. She will also be talking about how you can convert energy savings to emissions benefits. However, there is going to be some need to consider on-site emissions, and that is something that both Vignesh and Stacy will be addressing using either a rate-based or a mass-based approach. And then finally, because of the way the greenhouse gas rules are designed, we're going to need to turn to state policies, and Rodney is going to be addressing how state policies can create opportunities to advance these technologies. So with that, before I turn to Melissa, I see a lot of questions are already coming in. I encourage folks to ask questions. We will address them at the close of the planned presentation and address any questions we don't get to by email. And I also see that someone is using the chat feature. I'll answer that question in just a moment. But if you have any logistical questions for us, go ahead and present them there. And if you have any technical issues, you can use either the question mark at the top right or dial *0 for audio support. And with that, Melissa, why don't you talk about the economic benefits of recognizing CHP in the greenhouse gas rules. Melissa, are you there? Melissa?
Oh, yes. Thank you. So I thought I would start out for a moment and just talk about RED for those not familiar with us. We have been operating in this space, our principals have, for the past 3 decades. Our mission as a company is to find ways to profitably reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we do that by recycling waste energy. We partner with industrial facilities, and we help to develop energy islands that can meet their energy needs. We try and find wasted energy, so that can come in the form of waste off of process or waste thermal, and take that waste and put it to use so that it can be recycled and have a second life inside of the industrial. We currently have projects operating in California, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York. We have attempted to develop projects in the Midwest, thus far unsuccessfully, although there is a tremendous potential in the Midwest. Our projects are currently focused on the coasts. Over the past 35 years, our principals have developed over 300 projects, and those projects annually avoid about 5 million tons of CO2 emissions. While we've achieved verifiable emissions, we have not received any monetary benefit for those reductions. So we're a mission-driven company, and thus far we haven't figured out a way to monetize the benefits that we have been able to achieve through these projects. Well, there we go. I had some trouble switching the slide. So what we view 111D as the potential that would allow us to monetize some of these benefits. Potentially a carrot could exist inside of the Clean Air Act. So we're hopeful that this will actually turn out to be the case. And the reason that this is critical for us is because thus far, all of the projects we've developed, there hasn't been a way to monetize any of the environmental benefits. When we look at how do we structure these projects from a Clean Air Act perspective, our entire focus is on how do we avoid the punitive areas of the Clean Air Act. When we come into an industrial, how do we avoid NSR? How do we avoid PFD? There is no way to view these projects within the framework of the Clean Air Act on how the Clean Air Act can help incentivize these projects. So we are really hopeful that this rule will potentially provide that opportunity. The emission reduction benefits that come from these projects can be significant, and they're verifiable. And we are hoping that those two aspects will help us to attract additional investors to these projects. Currently, the investors that we've attracted of our projects are investors that share the same mission that we have. They're investors that are truly dedicated to finding ways to put money to use in the industrial space that has environmental benefits, and specifically that has greenhouse gas reduction benefits. The investors, though, are typically pretty risk-averse as it relates to environmental regulation. So we spent a fair amount of time de-risking the project from an environmental perspective in order to make them comfortable with it, because at the end of the day, they're still investors that need to make a return. So while they're attracted to these projects for some of the environmental benefits, we still need to demonstrate the return on these projects. And if there was a way to monetize these benefits, that would dramatically strengthen the ability to attract investors and increase the return and potentially put some of the projects that are sitting there right below their threshold over the threshold to make a return and attract investors to them. So what we're hoping is that these rules will provide a mechanism that acknowledges the environmental benefits, acknowledges the climate benefits that come from these projects, and provides a mechanism where there could be credits that could be sold from these projects so that we as investors can monetize that, and or we as developers can monetize that, and that would help us attract investors. So this is a picture of a site that we are operating in Rochester. It's at the Eastman Business Park. That's the coal facility, and when we view that as a tremendous opportunity for greenhouse gas reduction. The site is currently facing the Boilermast rule, and we evaluated several options of how to get the site in compliance. And those options ranged from installing back-end controls to fuel switching the boilers from coal to gas, which would reduce greenhouse gases by roughly 40%. The solution that we have selected is a solution that has us installing ultra-efficient CHP, and the reason we're calling it ultra-efficient is because it is going to be able to reach efficiencies that are in the 90s because we are putting HRSGs in that will be heavily duct-fired. And so we will cut emissions relative to the baseline today for CO2 by nearly 80%. This project is the highest capital of all of those projects, but the capital that we will be investing is accretive. We also will be able to verify that there are significant CO2 reductions that come from this project because the site has already been tracking its CO2. We have a very clear baseline that we can compare against. The ability to attract investors to this project, we've been lucky because of our track record, so we've been successful at doing that, but we would dramatically reduce the pool of investors we could go to try and bring additional capital into this space to help develop projects just like this throughout the Midwest if there was a way to monetize these benefits. Right now, the mere absence of a stick is not sufficient to attract investors. So within the framework of the Clean Air Act and the way that we structure these projects from an air permit perspective, we're able, for the most part, to avoid the sticks of the Clean Air Act. We can avoid NSR, we can avoid PSD by getting creative and structuring around that. But the absence of a stick is really not sufficient to attract investors. And we have looked and we have poured a lot of resources into figuring out a way to develop these projects in the Midwest because there is tremendous opportunity in the Midwest. And right now, we have not been successful at figuring out a way to attract capital to those projects. While the projects are technically feasible and they're very good projects at industrial sites that are in the upper quartile of their respective industries, without some additional acknowledgement of just how environmentally beneficial these projects are, it will continue to be a challenge and we will struggle to find investors that are willing to pour capital into these projects. So with that, I am going to hand it over to Bruce Hedman, and for those of you who are not familiar with Bruce, he's currently the technical director at the Institute for Industrial Productivity. He was previously with ICF. He is an expert in industrial energy and CHP, and he's going to talk about how do we account for the thermal output of these CHP projects.
Thanks, Melissa, and good morning, everyone, and thanks for the quick intro. Very briefly, Institute for Industrial Productivity, we're a nonprofit organization. We're part of the Climate Works Network, and our goal really is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through promoting best practices in industrial energy efficiency and productivity, and we really view CHP as a critical element in that best practice portfolio. I'm going to take a step back for a few minutes. Again, understanding we have a wide variety of experience in the attendees on this webinar. Jennifer asked me to again, take a little bit of a step back, talk about CHP as an energy efficiency measure, a little bit more detail on how it saves fuel and reduces emissions when it's deployed, and then the need to recognize sort of the unique energy efficiency characteristics of CHP in order to properly credit its benefits. So to do that, I'm really going to go back to a sort of a cartoon that's very similar to one that Jennifer used to highlight the efficiency benefits of CHP. In this slide, I'm comparing the overall energy consumption to provide specific energy services, in this case, 30 units of electricity and 45 units of steam, which is about the general proportion of what you would find in a gas turbine CHP system output. But to provide those specific energy services to a industrial or commercial facility. On the left, it shows how these services would be provided by conventional separate heat and power, and you can see the source energy going into providing those services. So in the case of the 30 units of electricity, at the power plant that has an average national fossil average efficiency of 35%, and if you include 6% TD losses, that's an overall conversion efficiency of 33%, and you need 91 units of fuel going into the power plant to deliver the 30 units of electricity to the site. As Jennifer said, the site would have an on-site boiler. If you assume that's 80% efficient, then it will take 56 units of fuel to provide the 45 units of steam needed in the process or in space heating or whatever that thermal energy is used for. On the right is combined heat and power. In this case, a 5-megawatt natural gas turbine. It can produce those 30 units of electricity, 45 units of steam, at an efficiency, if it's operated and designed properly, of about 75%, meaning that now you're using 100 units of fuel to produce the needed energy services at the site versus 147 units of fuel, the 91 units at the power plant and the 56 units at the on-site boiler to produce those same energy services with conventional separate heat and power. So you're comparing overall efficiencies to produce 30 units of power, 45 units of thermal energy. It's about 50% with separate heat and power, and in 75-70% with combined heat and power. While this example does show an overall efficiency of CHP to be 75%, you have to remember actual efficiencies will vary due to technology used, due to what how the plant operates, things like that. But typically, well-designed CHP systems will run in the overall efficiency range of 60 to 80% higher heating value. Now, the reason that last chart is so relevant to 111D, and this is the same chart that that Jennifer used before, is that the efficiency benefit of CHP generally results in lower greenhouse gas emissions in providing those needed energy services. Now, this is looking at calculating the CO2 emissions of comparing a combined heat and power system, 5-megawatt natural gas combustion turbine running 7,000 hours a year, providing 35,000 megawatt hours of power to the site, and just about 180,000 million BTUs of steam to the site. And that combined heat and power CHP system will produce about 23,000 short tons of CO2 in providing those energy services. Again, if we go back to our conventional separate heat and power, as Jennifer pointed out, the power station based on the U.S. average fossil mix would generate about 32,000 tons to produce that 35,000 megawatts of electricity, and the on-site boiler would produce about 13,000 tons of CO2 to produce the same amount of steam coming from the CHP system. So you have a significant CO2 savings from employing combined heat and power on-site as compared to separate heat and power. Now, I have to caution, how much that savings is depends on what you're displacing both at the site, what kind of on-site boiler you're displacing, and what you're displacing back at the central station power plant. If you're in California and the mix is very different than the average fossil mix, which includes a lot of coal and natural gas, your savings would be less. That's part and parcel of the whole question of how you recognize the benefits of CHP is what are the assumptions you use in what you're displacing both at the site and at the power plant. So while CHP can produce significant efficiency and emissions benefits, it's also not your normal energy efficiency measure. There are some unique characteristics that need to be recognized and accounted for. Number one, CHP systems produce both power and thermal outputs using a single fuel input. And again, this is how it gets its efficiency benefits. It recovers that heat normally wasted in power production. Fuel and CO2 savings come from displacing on-site boilers or furnaces and producing the thermal power, and also in displacing central station generation, including T&D losses. And as both Jennifer and Melissa pointed out, CHP actually may result in increased fuel use or emissions at the site. But again, it's the overall system fuel use and emissions that need to be considered, and that's where the benefits of CHP come in. So in order to really get those benefits, it's critical to recognize the multiple outputs of CHP and the impacts beyond the site in order to properly credit the efficiency and emissions benefits. So it is a little bit different than normal energy efficiency measures. To set the stage for the discussion of the presenters that follow me, I'm going to step through some very basic but important concepts on how to calculate CHP savings and then how to account for multiple outputs, and I'll try to do that pretty efficiently here. The first two, how to calculate overall fuel savings and emission savings, I'll step through these very quickly. It's sort of self-evident. We essentially did this already in the cartoon examples I just used. But the fuel savings is going to be equal from CHP, is going to be equal to the fuel that would normally have been consumed in separate heat and power minus the fuel now consumed in the CHP system to provide those energy services. So it's the fuel use from avoided on-site thermal energy production, the boiler that I've displaced. It's fuel use from avoided purchase grid electricity, the central station generation that I've displaced, minus the fuel use by the CHP system that gives you your total fuel savings. And in the case of the cartoon example I used, it's you had 147 units of separate heat and power fuel, 56 from the on-site boiler, 91 from the generator, minus 100 units from the CHP system fuel, a savings of 47 units or 32% savings over the amount of energy needed to deliver those energy services by separate heat and power. Similarly, for CO2 savings, CO2 savings is the CO2 that would have been emitted in separate heat and power to provide those energy services minus the CO2 emitted by the CHP system in providing those energy services. CO2 emissions, so it's from the avoided on-site thermal production, CO2 emissions plus CO2 emissions from the avoided purchase grid electricity minus CO2 emissions from the CHP system. That's your total CO2 savings. Again, in the example that I used in the two charts, the emissions from separate heat and power were 13,000 tons for the on-site boiler, 32,000 tons for the central station power plant, minus 23,000 tons for the CHP system, or a net decrease of 22,000 tons CO2 by using CHP. And that's about a 48% reduction in CO2 compared to the separate heat and power place. That's a little more than your straight energy savings, because often CO2 also results in a fuel, in using cleaner fuels. This is based on natural gas, gas turbine as a combined heat and power system. And in this example, at least, what we're displacing is, yes, a natural gas boiler at the site, but we're displacing a mix of coal and natural gas and other fuels at the electric grid at the central station. And that's where you get your even more CO2 savings in the comparison. The big question is, you know, what are the avoided emissions from the displaced purchase power? What are the avoided emissions from displaced on-site boilers? How do you determine what would have been displaced, what would have been used, and use the appropriate assumptions? So So once you can see how the fuel and emission savings of CHP are generated, and how it is a little bit different than your typical energy efficiency measures, that normally energy efficiency would reduce electric or fuel use directly at the facility. Here you have to take into account the sort of the overall system. The key to recognizing CHP benefits is in any regulatory structure really is to somehow credit the multiple outputs of CHP, electricity and thermal energy. There is regulatory experience in this area, primarily in the area of output-based regulations. Output-based regulations essentially try to promote efficiency by expressing the limits in terms of pounds or tons per useful output. It could be pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour generated. And there are two approaches that have been used in implementing output-based emissions standards for crediting CHP. There's a, and I'll get into these in a slide each in some detail, but there's an equivalent approach and avoided emissions approach. The two approaches can result in different levels of emission rates based on your CHP system characteristics and the emission rates of what you're avoiding. And that's something to contend with. They're not drastically different, but they can be different. And I do think which approach is eventually used is influenced and should be influenced by really what the overall regulatory structure is and what the objectives are. And you'll see that to date, both approaches have been used by various regulatory entities, again, based on their objectives. The equivalent approach directly adds the thermal output to the electric output of the CHP system in consistent or equivalent units, most normally in megawatt hours. In the case I was looking at before, the total output was 30 units of electricity, 45 units of steam. In the equivalence approach, your total output would be the addition of those 75 units. And then you would divide that total output into your total emissions release, basically to come up with a pounds per megawatt hour or pounds per whatever unit of fuel you're using. Now, the value of that conversion factor, how you convert thermal into megawatt hours, if you're going to do it all on a megawatt hour basis, depends, again, on the underlying regulatory objectives. It can be based on a straight unit conversion where 3,412 BTUs equals 1 kilowatt hours. That would mean you're crediting 100% of the thermal output. Or you can incorporate a factor, as some regulatory structures have done, for the relative value of the outputs. 111B credits 75% of the thermal output. In that case, you can see that that does have an impact on what your denominator would be when you calculate your pounds per megawatt hour emissions rate. And the results can vary based on the ratio of power and heat output of the system. But just to give you a sense, if we take that 5-megawatt gas turbine example that I had used before, running 7,000 hours a year, if you do the straight equivalence approach using 100% of the thermal output as your factor, you get an emissions rate of 525 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. If you use 75% of the thermal output as a factor, you get an emissions rate of 618 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour, just to give you a sense of the impact of these things. The second approach to crediting the multiple outputs is the avoided emissions approach. And this is an approach where you credit the CHP system really basically with the avoided emissions that a conventional separate heat and power system would otherwise emit to provide the same energy services. In the way we're looking at it for a power generator, it really relates the value of the thermal output from the CHP system to the emissions that would have been avoided are avoided by the displacement of the on-site boiler or furnace. In results can vary, based on the thermal unit displaced. Are you displacing a new gas on-site boiler? Are you displacing an old coal boiler? Are you displacing some default boiler that may be part of the regulations. But again, if we go back to that example I had used before of the 5-megawatt gas turbine, and we do it on an avoided emissions approach where you're displacing an 80% efficient natural gas boiler with the thermal output from the system, your emissions rate for CO2 is 570 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour. And you can see this rate is right between 100% and 75% sort of thermal factor that the equivalence method came up with. I just want to caution that all these numbers can vary quite a bit depending on the technology, the power to heat ratio, that kind of thing. So it is very, I think, complicated to think about which emissions approach you want to use. And again, it goes back to whatever your regulatory structure is and your objectives are that you're trying to meet. I had said earlier that both approaches have been used in regulatory experience. You can see here that California, Texas have both used the equivalence approach in their distributed generation and conventional emission limits for on-site generation. Connecticut, Delaware, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island have used the avoided emissions approach in their small EEG rules and their conventional emissions limits. Up to now, US EPA has used the equivalence approach in several of their rules, the electric utility steam generating unit, NSPS subpart DA, uses the equivalence approach with a 75% thermal credit. The gas turbine NSPS subpart KKK uses the equivalence approach with 100% thermal credit. The proposed rule for greenhouse gas emissions from new electric generating units, that should be 111B, used the equivalence approach from a 75% thermal credit. EPA has actually created a number of very, very useful resources if you want to learn about what are the savings benefits of CHP, how do you account for CHP and output-based regulations. For that stuff, the crediting of CHP, there are a number of white papers on the EPA-CHP partnership website. The first one, fuel and CO2 savings calculation methodology for CHP systems. The second one, accounting for CHP and output-based regulations, goes in depth at the difference between equivalence and avoided emissions approaches for accounting for CHP multiple outputs. And there is also a CHP emissions calculator that allows you to put in your specific performance attributes of a CHP system and comparing it to the what you're saving at the grid and what you're displacing on-site. And you can vary that depending whether you're looking at states, whether you're looking at NERC regions, EGRD regions, and whether you want to compare it to average fossil or the non-base load average that you would get out of EGRID. And along with that, EPA also has some great resources in calculating the avoided emissions. How do you calculate what you're displacing back at the central station or avoiding? There are some guidance in the EPA roadmap for EERE in SIPs. There is EGRID, which is the Emissions and Generation Resource Integrated Database that basically has, from a unit basis, compiles heat rates and emissions for central station power for different regions in the United States. And most recently, there's the AVERT Emissions Quantification Tool. And I have to admit, I can't remember what AVERT stands for, but this is really a tool for states and others to sort of put in energy efficiency, renewable energy resources with some sense of how they operate. Are they operating peak? Are they operating base load? And it will give you a sense of what the avoided emissions are at the central station site. Again, with that as background, I think what I'll do now is turn the helm over to Vignesh Gaurishankar of NRDC, who's really going to talk now about how CHP could be incorporated into compliance plans for 111D. Vignesh?
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Am I audible? I hope so.
Yes.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Great. Thanks, Bruce, for that background. So I'm going to sort of pick up from where Bruce left off. And Bruce talked about how the emissions reductions, emission reduction from CHP can be calculated. And I'm going to sort of take the next step and talk about how this can actually translate to some sort of a credit for CHP. So Bruce mentioned emissions, described emissions reductions and how they can be calculated by accounting for both the thermal and electric output. And he talked about both, you know, the equivalence as well as the avoided emissions approach as possible options for calculating these emissions reductions. What that would lead to is, and this is something that I'll touch upon more, but also something that Bruce touched upon already, these emissions reductions would lead to either a lower emission rate or fewer total emissions. Very quickly on the lower emission rate, it's essentially by accounting for your thermal output, the rate of, you know, for example, the pounds per megawatt hour would be reduced because you're accounting for in the case of the equivalence approach, for example, you're accounting for both the electric and the thermal output in your denominator, and you're converting the thermal to the electric. So you're getting a lower emission rate because you're able to account for both electric and thermal output. And then the fuel total emission is sort of an equivalent approach as well, which just sort of results in fewer total emissions that you can ascribe to the kilowatt hours of electricity produced. So as a result of either a lower emission rate or fewer total emissions, as this slide shows, you could potentially get credits. Just by the way, the picture at the bottom is just sort of a stylized version of the one that Bruce already showed. So this is actually the same numbers even that Bruce had in his second graphic. What is important, though, is that in order for the regulatory framework to account for and ultimately benefit CHP, it's essential for there to be a system-based approach to the emission standards. And the reason for this is, you know, it's quite fundamental. CHP systems, this sort of holds true for energy efficiency and even renewables, is that, but in particular CHP systems, is that they, while they can be built within a power plant site, they're much more likely to be built elsewhere. For example, at an industrial facility or a commercial building, or, you know, as these pictures show right next to the words third-party CHP, it shows CHP, you know, in a district energy setting, in a greenhouse, and in a manufacturing facility. The standard, ideally the standard would be system-based in that it would allow for emissions reductions that occur outside of the power plant fence, or the fence line, as it's sometimes called. And only in so doing can the emissions reductions from CHP be adequately accounted for and ultimately benefit the system as well as be benefited by the regulatory framework, which allows for those emissions reductions to translate to credit. So the fundamental, the takeaway here really is that a system-based approach is essential for CHP, and as it would be for energy efficiency and other clean energy resources as well. I keep pressing the page down. Now, one example of a state-based approach is the NRDC proposal that we've been describing and presenting on over the past few months. And I must stress, this is only one example, and there are many variations of it. But in order for us to sort of undertake the modeling and see what the effect of this could be, we had to obviously, you know, go with certain assumptions and a certain framework. Now, what our proposal has in it is it establishes state-specific emission rates. And emission rates here are calculated as pounds per megawatt hour of electricity produced. And the proposal essentially establishes rates for 2020 and 2025. the way these targets, the target emissions rate, are actually calculated are by applying benchmark coal and gas rates to each state's baseline fossil fuel mix. So, and the baseline was the years 2008 to 2010, just because that was the latest data we had when we embarked on modeling. And so, for example, if you have a 50% gas and 50% coal, we would take the 50% coal and multiply it by its benchmark emission rate, and 50% gas multiplied by its benchmark emission rate to come up with a state target that is sort of a mix or an average of a weighted average of both coal and gas. Now, talking about compliance, each fossil unit would be allowed to average its emission rate with other fossil units in the state. So it doesn't have to be, you know, one plant sort of doing it all on its own, but it can sort of average and its so-called sort of quote-unquote partner with other fossil fuel units in the state. Now, when it comes to crediting renewables and energy efficiency and cleaner energy resources, what essentially happens is that, let's take the example of renewables, which is, you know, simple to understand. The renewables would produce no pounds of emissions because they are, by definition, a renewable source. Such as solar or wind, for example, but they would generate megawatt hours. So the rate would then be, you know, the numerator for that particular source's rate would be zero on the numerator, and the megawatt hours would be some positive number. And when this is mixed in with your entire fossil fleet, that would result in a reduction of the system's emissions. Energy efficiency is sort of similar in concept, because ultimately it leads to sort of megawatt hours, or if you want to think of it, megawatt hours, negative, with no emissions also. Now, CHP is a little bit different because the emissions are not zero. There is a increase in the emissions because you are needing to burn extra fuel. However, because the CHP system is energy efficient, as was explained by Bruce, it does result in net emissions reductions. And how this would be reflected is in our rate-based approach, it would result in fewer pounds per megawatt hour than, for example, a central station power plant. And this would be arrived, by the way, either via a equivalence approach or by the avoided emissions approach, that both of which Bruce described. Of course, as Bruce caveated, the exact magnitude and the numbers may shift a little bit depending on the assumptions, but nonetheless, when a CHP is properly designed and properly operated, we can expect a CHP system to be very efficient and grid, and because of that, the effective emissions rate for the megawatt hours generated by the CHP would be lower and would result in lowering the fleets or the states, the region's effective emissions rate. And then very quickly, the proposal would also allow for interstate averaging, so states could sort of average and trade credits between each other or amongst a few of them. And NRDC, I must stress, is very open and would encourage alternative plans if they work better in certain settings or in certain states. And as I said, we took this approach for the purposes of modeling. Yes, we do think that it has certain advantages, but if certain other approaches work in other states more effectively, then we're all for it. What we ultimately want is for the power plant sector to reduce its overall emissions over time. Very quickly, this slide is just to show that the proposal has different cases or different scenarios, rather, of how much of different resources could potentially be present in the future, depending on different assumptions and circumstances. And we have sort of different levels of efficiency and so on. And the only point here is that in all of the scenarios, energy efficiency is expected to play a large part, and CHP could one part or a part of that total energy efficiency pool. Great. I did gloss over one thing somewhat quickly in a previous slide, and that is sort of, you know, as you think about carbon pollution standards, you can sort of think about it in sort of two broad paradigms. One is the so-called rate-based approach, of which the NRDC proposal is an example, and the mass-based approach. In the rate-based approach, the target is set by, you know, a rate, which is a pounds per kilowatt hour or pounds per megawatt hour type rate. In the mass-based approach, it is the target is set by a absolute tons of emissions generated. Now, in the rate-based approach, the CHP, as Bruce sort of walked you through, would generate electricity at a lower effective emissions rate, and that's where the incentive, so to speak, is derived from, the lower emission rate, a rate that is lower, and we can sort of expect that a CHP's rate is lower than a state's target. In a mass-based approach, and this Stacey's going to talk to you a little bit, Stacey Davis in the next section is going to talk to you a little bit more about the, when properly accounted for, CHP systems would result in fewer total emissions, and that's where the incentive for that is derived from. And very quickly in the next slide, as we are approaching sort of with 1 hour in, I want to wrap up quickly. This is just to show that, this slide here is just to show that there are different, there could be different ways of possible implementation of the carbon pollution standards depending on, you know, either the different mechanisms already in place in the state or the different regulatory approaches that a state might want to adopt. And the first one, just as an example, is one that is potentially compatible with a rate-based approach, and this is essentially provision of credits for emissions reductions. And again, this is an example, but if you just sort of humor me for a moment, a utility may be required to achieve an effective emissions rate as per the set targets, and a utility could meet these requirements by counting low emissions generations from third-party sources like wind and solar, energy efficiency, and combined heat and power, of course. And the utilities could then provide a monetary or other benefit to these third-party sources for helping it meet its requirements. Now, there was a question, I believe, about how utilities could benefit, and this is sort of one example of how that could happen. Utilities are required to meet the emissions target, and they draw on these cleaner energy resources that are sort of in its footprint, for example, to achieve the reductions. There is another example that I won't go through here that could work in a rate-based approach, and what I want to do now is to turn it over to Stacey Davis, who's going to talk you through the other paradigm that I just sort of give you a heads up on, which is a mass-based approach, and also sort of talk through many of those details. So over to you, Stacey.
Let me jump in quickly before we have the introduction for Stacey. I'm just mindful of the clock, and so I wanted to interject and say, first of all, while I imagine that everyone here has busy schedules, we do not lose our conference line promptly at 12:30, so are happy to stay on for a few extra minutes to continue wrapping up. I also encourage people to keep sending questions in. I will plan on downloading those questions, and each of the panelists will be responding via email. If you'd like, you can make a note as to who you're directing the question to. I think that's it, so we can go back to Stacey. Keep the questions coming and keep the chat coming. It looks like there's been kind of a bit of a dialogue there as well, which I really appreciate.
So thanks, Vignesh and Jennifer. I'll be talking about how CHP can be encouraged under a mass-based standard. And so to begin, I know Vignesh has already briefly introduced what a mass-based standard is, but different from a rate-based standard, it's in the form of total number of tons per year as opposed to pounds per megawatt hour. And it's typically implemented through a system-based approach, essentially, where the tonnage limit is forced by distributing in some way, either by selling or by giving away allowances up to the absolute number. Covered sources must then hold an allowance for each ton of emissions, and then sources decide whether to buy or sell allowances depending on how their compliance costs compare with the market price. And this approach can be implemented either within a state or across two or more states at the regional level or even nationally. And we do expect that EPA will allow states to comply using a mass-based approach, in particular because it supports all those states that are part of REGI and California that have mass-based approaches that they'd like to use as the means of implementing 111D. But we also think it could be desirable for states forecasting declining load growth, and it could be simpler to implement than a rate-based approach. So we do expect that this would be an option. In terms of how that option is specified in an actual standard, EPA could do it and specify the mass-based standard that would be equivalent to the rate-based standard, or EPA could offer a methodology for doing so. So under a mass-based program, clean energy sources, such as energy efficiency, renewable energy, and combined heat and power, whether through utility programs or state policies or private sector investments, they can play an important role in helping the covered sources reduce their emissions. And therefore, you know, as a result of this contribution, covered sources have to purchase fewer allowances. However, under a typical mass-based program design, these clean energy sources don't earn emissions credit for this help that they're providing. If they did, this would result in double counting. So essentially, the emissions reductions from any given energy efficiency or renewable or CHP project would already be seen through the emissions reductions measured through the continuous emission monitors at the covered sources. And so if you also give credit for to the energy efficiency or CHP developer, you'd essentially be giving credit twice for the same action, unless it's done through a set-aside, and I'll get to that in just a minute. So we just learned that clean energy helps out the covered sources but doesn't necessarily get credit. At the same time, a mass-based standard does automatically encourage low-carbon investments, mainly by making higher-carbon investments more expensive. So for covered sources, allowance costs factor into the variable cost of generation, which affects the price at which they bid electricity into the market and likely raising the price of the marginal unit and therefore electricity prices. The higher emitting sources would pay more than lower emitting sources, which we think should bode well for sources for covered CHP units, so long as the emissions calculations properly account for thermal energy, as Bruce Hedman sort of discussed. And they also need to purchase fewer allowances than other covered sources, and at the same time, they should get a better price for any power that they are selling to the grid. Whether that happens remains to be seen, but in theory, they should be getting a better price as a result. We would also want to make sure that any free allocations treat CHP units fairly, the ones that are covered under the system. Clean energy units that are not covered by the standard do not see higher costs, and the electricity prices should encourage new combined heat and power and other new clean energy resources. One note is that any new uncovered CHP that comes in as a reaction to a mass-based standard does add emissions that are not covered by the standard. However, this leakage is similar to that from other uncovered small power generators. So a key question is whether a mass-based standard is good enough as is in encouraging clean energy or whether a more direct incentive is needed. Some would argue that changing the relative prices, you know, covered versus uncovered sources, and increasing electricity prices already offers a strong market incentive and effectively recognizes the benefits of clean energy. Others would argue that a more direct incentive is needed. There could be a strong argument for this if covered sources were given free allowances. Also, others are looking for a more direct way to monetize the benefits provided by clean energy, and maybe market pricing isn't enough. So one remedy that could be offered is to without breaking the cap, is to establish a set-aside program. This is essentially a pool of allowances from the total that was initially available that is dedicated to supporting clean energy technologies. So clean energy sources could earn these allowances by quantifying their emissions reductions, potentially using the AVERT tool or other methods. And this could be done either on a first-come, first-served basis or by offering a pro-rata share to all clean energy applicants. So a key issue for combined heat and power in accessing emissions or the allowances from a set-aside pool is that unlike other clean energy sources, there are some off-site emissions attributable to electricity generation. So if CHP units are awarded allowances from the set-aside and sells them to covered sources, those covered sources would emit up to the mass-based standard, plus you'd have those additional emissions from the CHP unit that are associated with electricity production. So a solution to this is for the CHP unit to earn the set-aside allowances based on electric sector emissions reduced, but then to retire a share of those allowances equal to its own electric sector or electric emissions. And one final note is that some variants to a mass-based approach have been proposed. These designs could also be adjusted to reward the benefits of clean energy, including CHP. For example, GRE, the Great River Energy, and the Brattle Group have proposed implementation of a mass-based standard at a regional level, and they've proposed it through the MISO Regional Transmission Organization region using a carbon price path that could be adjusted periodically to ensure the standard is met. Under their proposal, covered sources pay this price and are therefore encouraged to emit less, and they propose to return revenues raised from the carbon price to ratepayers. So in this case, there would be no allowances available to create a set-aside for clean energy sources, but instead one way to reward clean energy sources for their contribution to compliance would be to allocate a share of the revenues for this purpose. So that's all I had. Vignesh and I just shared how CHP fits into rate-based and mass-based programs. Next, Rodney Sobin, a director of the Alliance to Save Energy, will bring us home with the discussion of state policies.
Thank you, and also apologies to everyone. Of all the days, today is when the neighboring suite decided to do some construction, so you may hear some background noise. I did want to turn back to state policies. As Jennifer had noted at the beginning, the way 111D works is that EPA will come out with what are called emissions guidelines to which states must respond with an implementation plan. So how they will implement reductions at least equivalent to what the federal emissions guidelines will require. So not only do they have to put together implementation plans, but they have to implement what is in those plans. We anticipate that there will be considerable flexibility for states to use a variety of different policies. That EPA will likely look favorably upon a variety of existing policies that are out there. So, for example, about half the states have energy efficiency resource standards or similar sorts of requirements which require electric utilities to reduce electricity sales versus business as usual scenarios. Further, of course, many states have renewable portfolio standards or alternative energy portfolio standards, which is sort of a variation of that. So we anticipate that EERs, RPSs, and similar sorts of policy mechanisms are things that states could apply for 111D compliance. And certainly the REGI states are on top of this with their cap and trade system in the Northeast and California's AB 32. Towards the bottom of this slide, I note a number of what I call supporting policies. It's unclear whether certain of these policies would be something that you would directly put in the SIP as being responsible for a certain amount of emissions reductions. However, they support making energy efficiency or CHP or renewables more inviting. So these can be financial incentives, environmental regulations, as Bruce Hedman had noted, things like using output-based emission standards and crediting thermal energy from CHP. There are also increasing interest in energy reliability and resilience, especially post-Sandy and post-Katrina and post a number of ice storms and nor'easters, as well as things like interconnection and standby rates. I'm not going to go through these, this and the next map in any sort of detailed fashion, except to point out that the renewable and alternative energy portfolio standards, as well as the EERs, exist in a number of flavors. Some explicitly note CHP, others do not, but it's sort of implied to be an eligible resource. In some cases, which I'll point out a little more detail, a state may have a renewable portfolio standard, but also a cutout for other alternatives. Sometimes these are even for certain fossil energy sources and can include CHP. So here's a similar chart for EERS, or in some states are called EEPS, Energy Efficiency Portfolio Standards. But again, there are ways of accommodating and encouraging CHP through these sorts of policies. So the example here is Massachusetts, which has an alternative energy portfolio standard that is separate from its RPS. And the AEPS includes CHP, both renewably fueled as well as natural gas fueled, and provides for a thermal credit. Sometimes the devil is in the details in some of these policies, and so one favorable thing about the Massachusetts policy is that it allows aggregation of smaller units so they can qualify for the recognition under the portfolio standard. So since 2008, there were 74 new CHP units versus somewhat less in the previous decade. So that's just one example. In Maryland, there is an Empower Maryland program, which is part of a ratepayer program to encourage energy efficiency and renewables in the utility sector. A certain proportion of that is on the regulated utilities, and a certain proportion of the objective is outside of the utilities. But what I'll just mention here is Baltimore Gas and Electric, as an example. As part of their ratepayer energy efficiency program, they have a component that works with industry and both industrial and commercial and institutional customers. And one of the programs within that overall program is a CHP effort in which you're offering up to $2 million per project. It includes incentives for design as well as construction, so there's a bit of money sooner in the process, which can help facilitate projects, as well as what in essence is sort of like a production credit of 7 cents a kilowatt hour for the first 18 months of the project's operations. So this comes out roughly to about $700 a kilowatt subsidy. So the way Empower Maryland is working, they've received 16 proposals. They went through a number of reviews on technical and economic criteria. They have to meet the utilities' total resource cost-benefit analysis, and 11 have passed review and are proceeding. I'll just give a couple more examples. NYSERDA, New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, has provided a fair amount of money for CHP projects. There's also a CHP performance program. In New York, after Hurricane Sandy and some other events, there's also strong emphasis on the issue of resilience. And so the CHP program supports the resilience and energy security aspect as well as environmental and other objectives. California is also prominent with a self-generation incentive program oriented towards reducing peak loads. It includes renewables as well as combined heat and power and waste heat to power, and provides certain financial support. And I've learned, I don't know very much about this directly, but the Utility Commission in California is starting or is considering or is actually offering a feed-in tariff for small CHP facilities. As regards some of these supporting policies, as I've mentioned, there's increased interest in resilience and local and critical infrastructure. So a couple of states are starting to require that CHP be considered in the development of certain critical facilities, thinking of hospitals, police stations, and these sorts of facilities. A number of states have been facilitating CHP and waste heat recovery through their environmental rules. Bruce Hedman had mentioned this previously, so I won't say much, but includes things like output-based standards and credits for thermal energy recovery. In the case of Delaware, there's a provision to credit what are called otherwise flared gases. So think of landfill gas projects and sewage treatment plants, dairies, and certain other industries. And also for facilities where they're fairly standard, there is the opportunity for what's permit by rule or general permits, which is sort of a streamlined permitting process. I'll also mention utility regulations. They vary tremendously as far as interconnection standards, standby rates. One concern in the CHP community is that demand charges can be what's called ratcheted. So if you have your CHP down for maintenance at a certain time and you rely on the grid, of course you need to pay for the grid power and you're responsible for a certain amount of the fixed capital for the utility. However, you may end up in a situation where each month's charges over the as much as a year can be based on this one peak period where you have your CHP offline. So there are a number of approaches to mitigating that to be fair to the utilities as well as fair to the CHP host. This is the last slide, and it overlaps with some of the ones you've seen previously, just providing a number of resources, comments that we've provided at the Alliance to Save Energy, as well as I think some of the other folks on this call. Two EPA have really asked EPA to provide guidance and tools and technical assistance. States have varying experience with CHP as well as with efficiency and renewable programs, and they will need guidance in navigating how to deal with 111D, especially given that time is relatively short for coming up with plans, especially if you need to pass implement regulation, and particularly so in a number of states where legislation may be required. But fortunately, there are a variety of resources out there. Another, give again sort of a plug for the AVERT emissions quantification tool. I recommend that some folks take a look at that. A number of the questions in the chat feature had been about what to compare your CHP to, you know, what is the grid energy that you are displacing. And the AVERT tool is a relatively straightforward tool to use that provides, you know, reasonably good approximation of what your avoided emissions are. Bruce Hedman also mentioned the calculator on this EPA-CHP partnership page, and there are a number of resources there. I'll also give a plug for our colleagues at ACEEE who have been working in this space, and they published recently a template for SIPs to include energy efficiency resource standards. Their template is really oriented towards the NAAQS, the ambient air quality criteria pollutants. However, that sort of approach should be applicable to 111D as well. So that's the thumbnail sketch and a whirlwind tour, and I'll hand it back to Jennifer.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Rodney, and to all of the presenters. I think we covered a lot of ground very efficiently, which I guess works well for our call on efficiency technologies and the role they play. So, you know, I'm looking at my clock. I want to be mindful of time. We've had a lot of very good questions come through, and any that we aren't able to address here, we can respond to by email. We also will be making both a recording of today's webinar available to folks, along with the slides themselves. And as long as you registered, as you logged on, I'll be able to communicate with you after today's call. We did receive several questions from people saying, is anybody going to be working to prepare comments to EPA on 111D that folks can either sign on to or use as a starting point? And in response to that, I maintain a listserv for stakeholders who are interested in supporting energy efficiency and EPA rules. Traffic is fairly modest, and I know a number of the people on today's call are already a part of that list. But if you are not, I encourage you to drop me a note and ask to be added to that listserv. We will be holding a call to brainstorm contents for comments on 111D that relate to energy efficiency and CHP following the release of the rule. I also regularly circulate materials to folks there. So, for instance, after the rule comes out, I would put together a collection of relevant excerpts from the rule. We also have put together comments on 111B, the rule for new sources, and I'm very happy to share that with folks and for them to lift liberally from those comments. So though we're not soliciting sign-ons, we certainly are happy for that to be used as a template for others. We received a number of comments from people saying, you know, is it, we're assuming that central power is dirty. It may in fact not be, and that central power generation may not actually be at 33%. That's certainly true. You know, if you have natural gas facilities, they may be cleaner. This is kind of the standard assumptions when talking about combined heat and power. And those cleaner facilities would obviously be subject to, you know, have more relaxed requirements under the rule. And so those are not necessarily the facilities that are going to be pursuing this whole suite of different compliance options to reduce their emissions.
I just want to say two other points. One is that at least on the NRDC proposal, to the extent that you have dirtier generation, so to speak, quote unquote, you know, more emissive generation in your baseline year, it is easier. It would be easier for that state to achieve targets in 2020 and 2025. That's one point, sort of on that side. And on the second side, absolutely acknowledge that, you know, if the state has very clean generation, like California, for example, it would be harder for CHP to actually be cleaner than the grid, because it would require CHP to be designed properly and operated properly. So points well taken, but you know, those were examples, and the reality would obviously reflect the circumstances on the ground. Back to you, Jennifer.
And a final thought on that: if you look at all of the resources that Rodney was highlighting, including the AVERT tool, they would take into account what it is that you're actually displacing. So we've hit the hour, and I hear folks jumping off the line. There are some additional questions that came in. We'll respond to each of those by email. But I thank all of you for your participation in today's call. I hope you got as much out of it as we did.
Jennifer, do we want to offer to stay on the line for a few minutes, or for those who want to stay?
Sure. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording right now, though.